The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry with Joe McGill.
Good morning, good morning. How are you this morning? I'm Joe McGill and you're listening to the Saturday Supplement. And I hope I find you well wherever you are listening to us around the world on the Radio Kerry app or the Radio Kerry website or on the traditional wireless 96 to 98 FM. On the programme this morning, we'll hear from Finch Island-based author June O'Sullivan on her new book, The Sky Is Not Enough. Before Amelia Earhart, there was Mary Heath, the forgotten Irish aviatrix who conquered the skies. And Joe Queeley will be on to speak about his book, Tragedies of Clare. Now, the book includes episodes relating to the land war in the years around the Easter Rising, with one of the stories having a strong Kerry connection. And we'll also hear another episode of An Artist's Kingdom, which features artists from around the county, this time featuring Helen Richmond from just outside Cahersyveen. Now, I mentioned The Sky Is Not Enough is a new book by June O'Sullivan on Mary Heath, who was born in Knockaderry and raised in Newcastle West. Now, June is an author based on Valentia Island, and this is her second published book. And I caught up with her during the week to talk about it. Lady Mary Heath, born Sophie Pierce Evans in Limerick, became a global icon in the 1920s. Britain's first female commercial pilot, the first woman to parachute from a plane, and on the 12th of February 1928, the daring aviatrix departed in a biplane to fly 10,000 miles solo from Cape Town to London. She even later sold Earhart the very plane she'd flown. Now acclaimed novelist June O'Sullivan, who also wrote The Lighthouse Keeper's Wife, revives Sophie Pierce Evans' astonishing life in a powerful new book, just in time for the centenary of that epic flight. A story of adventure, resilience and feminism, this is the forgotten Irish woman who conquered the skies despite her childhood trauma. And I'm delighted to say that June O'Sullivan, originally from Limerick, now living on Valentia Island, joins me now to talk about this wonderful new book, The Sky Is Not Enough. June, you're very welcome. How are you this morning?
Thank you, Joe. Thanks very much for having me.
So tell us about Sophie Pierce, or Lady Mary Heath, as she later became known as. Now, I would have came across her because when I was working in Newcastle West, we did a documentary on her. But what surprised me is not a lot of people even in West Limerick knew about her. So how did she come across your radar?
Similar, I suppose, Joe, in that I was surprised when I did find out about her. I was shocked that I hadn't known about her before. So I actually grew up very close to the village where she was born. So I say I'm from Newcastle West. I'm actually from near Knockaderry, but people don't really know that. So it's easier to say Newcastle West. So Sophie Pierce was born in Knockaderry, and I spent my whole childhood cycling up and down that hill past her house, completely unaware that the house was there or that she had lived there. And it wasn't until I was actually in my mid-20s, I was working in a bar in Knockaderry village. Myself and my husband were running the bar at the time, and I was locking up on my own one night, and the older lads at the bar were trying to kind of get a bit of a rise out of me, as you'd say. So they were trying to frighten me, saying, "Oh, would you not be nervous now staying here on your own," and that kind of thing. And then they started saying, "Did you ever hear about the murder house? Did you ever hear about the murder house down the road?" And I thought they were just having me on, to be honest, initially. But that was the first I heard of it. And obviously my interest was piqued. So I went looking into it then, and I could not believe that, you know, no, I had never heard of her before. She wasn't in the history books. We didn't learn about her in school. You know, this woman should be known, and was known around the world in her time, but just has kind of fallen into a bit of oblivion.
Yeah, and she's like an unbelievable role model as well, and a female role model as well. Just in relation to you're kind of mentioning the murder house there, and I'd say people's ears have kind of picked up a little. But yeah, she was born into kind of terrible circumstances in a way.
Yes. So her father was kind of landed a gentry. He was the son of the GP in Newcastle West, very respectable family. But he was quite wild. He inherited the house in Knockaderry. Knockaderry House, a big estate, from his maternal uncle. And he just went on a rampage, really. He was, you know, gambling and drinking and frequently in trouble with the law. He married his housekeeper, which obviously would have been a big scandal at the time. He would have been expected to marry somebody kind of the same social standing. So he married his housekeeper, and that was Sophie's mother. So they were married and they had Sophie. And then a year later, he actually murdered his wife in that house. So it had been a very violent marriage, you know, from the day they met, really a violent relationship. And that's how it ended. Unfortunately, he beat her to death in the kitchen. And Sophie then was taken in and raised by her grandfather and her aunts in Newcastle West.
Yeah, and that's, I think, is it the AIB bank there that there's a plaque on the wall that says, you know, this was the home of, you know, Sophie
yes.
Pierce or whatever, yeah. So, yeah, that's another kind of a little landmark there that people walk by every day and they wouldn't realise the significance of it. So, like, her grandfather then was a lot more stable and she had a better upbringing than I'd imagine from there.
She did, but he was very strict. So he was, you know, very strict Victorian kind of a gentleman. And I think because of what happened with his only son, his son ended up in the criminal asylum in Dublin until he died in 1916. So I think he kept her very much under wraps, partly probably because he was afraid of the gossip and things like that following her, but also just to keep her on the straight and narrow. There was always kind of a fear that she would take after her father or indeed her mother. So she had a very quiet childhood. She didn't go to school outside of the home. She was schooled in the home and she was only allowed to walk in the domain, the park in the town, chaperoned, and had very little freedom. So it was really, she had a better childhood than she would have had, I suppose, otherwise, but very restricted.
Mm. And do you think, you know, as a writer, I suppose, you know, the character development is hugely important to you and you're trying to get inside the head of a character. Mm-hmm. Do you think her upbringing or her childhood or even the trauma or else the strictness and restrictiveness made her more adventurous later, or what effect did that have on her, do you think, as an adult then?
Yeah, I think definitely the restriction of her childhood just made her yearn for freedom. And she said that herself, that once she got a taste of freedom, that was it. There was no putting her back into that box. Her parent situation, I think, is a bit more complicated because she lied about it quite a lot. So she would tell people that she was an orphan. And I suppose that was an easier way to explain it. But she would say that her father died before she was born and her mother died in childbirth. So I think she kind of struggled to kind of accept her circumstances or to explain it to people. So that was an easier way around it.
Mm. She went on then to kind of amazing success, like from a sporting point of view as well. She was in the Olympics and then from the pilot, flying point of view. So just tell us about her kind of as she went on into adulthood and how did she become Lady Mary Heath as well?
So she went from, she was allowed to go to boarding school, which was a huge thrill for her. funny to think of it for us now, but she excelled academically. She excelled in sports. She went on to study in the Royal College of Science in Dublin. And not many women were in third level education at the time. So that was incredible. When she was there, she married a man who was twice her age. And I think she was looking for a bit of financial security, maybe. She signed up to join the Women's Army Auxiliary Corps and went to the front line during World War One as a motorcycle dispatch rider. And then when she came back from there, she lived in East Africa for a time with her husband. He had started running a coffee farm. And then she came back to London. They were kind of estranged and she became very involved in athletics. So she made and broke world records pretty much in everything that she participated in. So in particular, the high jump and the javelin. Mm. She set up the Women's Amateur Athletic Association. And she was very instrumental in the campaign to get women included in the Olympic Games, because at the time it was for men only. So she actually flew to Prague to give a speech to the Congress on, you know, advocating for women athletes being allowed in to the Games. And on the flight home, she got chatting to somebody about airplanes and aviation, and that became her next obsession. So she was based in London by now. She was one of the founding members of the London Aeroplane Club, got her A license in no time at all, which allowed her to fly just privately. And then she thought, OK, this is a really good opportunity for my career. If I can get a commercial license, I can make a living carrying passengers. But you needed a lot of money to fly or to be a pilot and to have your own plane and things like that. So her first husband, they had been estranged and he died in 1927. his body was found in the Thames, and she set her sights on marrying a wealthy man. Like, she was quite blatant about it. She was quite upfront about it being a kind of a practical, pragmatic decision on her part. So she found a very wealthy man, Sir James Heath, and they married. She was 30 and he was 75.
Whoa.
Yeah. So, you know, it's like that old line, what did you first see in The Millionaire? but yeah, he funded her next exploits then, which was the flight in Africa.
That's June O'Sullivan there, and we're going to return to June after this break.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shop and Seafood Bar, the Mall Tralee. Treat yourself to the freshest takeaway fish and chips today, right in the heart of Tralee.
Now let's return to the interview I did during the week with June O'Sullivan on her book, The Sky Is Not Enough, all about Mary Heath. Is this book, is it a biography or is it a bit of fiction mixed with her life story, or how would you describe it?
Yeah, so it is a novel, but very closely based on her. And I suppose from the day, first time I heard her story, I just thought, oh my God, this has to be written. And I kind of stayed away from it a little bit. I think it was such a huge story. It's hard to even summarize it in a couple of sentences. And also I just wanted to do her justice. So I was a bit nervous about touching the topic myself. There is an excellent biography out there, which I have to mention, by Lindy Nocton. And it's called Lady Icarus, which is a brilliant title. I wish I thought of it first. for anyone who wants a kind of cradle to the grave, it's brilliant and it's really well researched. I didn't want to do a full life story for that reason, because then that kind of is a biography. And I really wanted to shine light on her achievement because, you know, people are really interested, as I was initially, in the more salacious kind of details of her life. But I think that can take a little bit from what she achieved. So what I decided, it took me a long time to decide on a structure, but what I decided to do in the end was to focus on the flight that made her famous, when she flew 10,000 miles up the length of Africa to Croydon on her own in an open cockpit plane. It was madness. But she did it and she survived. So that is kind of the spine of the book, if you like. I'm telling the story of her undertaking that flight. And then I've kind of woven in her backstory up to when she started that flight. So the book ends when the flight ends. And hopefully that'll inspire people then to go off and find out more about her.
And are you kind of imagining what would have gone on in that flight and mixed in then with the facts as well, kind of thing? Is that the way it would work?
Yeah, exactly. And I was very lucky that she actually wrote an account of the flight herself. So she published a couple of things. She published a collection of poetry when she was living in Africa, a book about athletics, and she published a book about called Women and Flying with another journalist called Stella Wolfe Murray. So there's a whole account of her flight in that book. So I was able to rely on that for the kind of the facts and the weather conditions and what animals she saw and that kind of thing. But what I really wanted to do was to get inside her head, because that account is very kind of stiff upper lip, dry, you know, and then I saw an elephant and then I landed, and, you know, it's in that kind of style of the time. So I wanted to really kind of get inside her head and try and imagine her thoughts, her feelings, you know, the flashbacks, the memories, and why was she doing it all? What was driving her? What was motivating her? Yes, she wanted fame. Yes, she wanted to make money and live independently and not have to depend on anybody. But I feel there was something else driving her as well.
You mentioned Lady Icarus there, and I think the front cover, like, she's dressed to the nine. She'd have a hat on as well. But of course, that was kind of a PR move as well. That, like, she'd be dressed normally, kind of flying the plane. But when she'd get out, then she'd have the big fur coat and all this.
Yeah, she was extremely clever. And I think she knew that, you know, if she came across as too masculine or too kind of bullish about her abilities, it would put people off her. So she was very clever. She would, like you said, she would complete her flight and then she'd get into her high heels, her fur coat, and she'd put on the makeup and a bit of lipstick, and she'd step out of the cockpit looking incredibly glamorous and then say, you know, oh, I mean, it's no big deal. You know, if little old me can do it, I'm only a woman, and if I can do it, sure, anyone can do it. So she was very clever in the way that she kind of created this persona in the press. And of course it got headlines, because everybody and the photographs there, you know, show you it's not what you expect to see coming out of a plane. So it was very clever.
Yeah, not to pitch two women against each other here, like two brilliant women, Amelia Earhart and Sophie Pierce, but like it is said that Amelia Earhart was probably, like you mentioned her, and everyone knows her name, but that her husband, I think, was he in PR, and he was involved with the Wright brothers and all that, so that, you know, he was better at kind of telling her story, and maybe that's why Sophie Pierce was kind of at a disadvantage. And also that Amelia Earhart had someone helping her in the flights, where Sophie Pierce was just unbelievable at it.
She was incredible, and she did all of her own mechanics, she did all of her own maintenance on the plane. She had to draw her own atlases or her own maps from atlases because there weren't any available for vast sections of Africa. They were good friends themselves. So, you know, even I feel very defensive about Sophie Pierce whenever Amelia Earhart comes up, but they were friends and they didn't see each other as competitors. And as you mentioned in the intro, she sold her plane to Amelia Earhart after the flight because Amelia Earhart was so impressed by what she had achieved and how well maintained the plane was. But yes, Amelia Earhart's husband was a very good PR man. And in the Lady Icarus book, it does say that he was able to kind of strategize and, you know, where maybe Lady Heath would have been proposed for a flight or an exhibition, he'd convince the organizers to swap her out for Amelia Earhart, basically. Mm. And then, of course, the whole issue around the disappearance of Amelia Earhart, I suppose, kind of adds to the mystery of her story. Whereas we do know what happened to Sophie Pierce. And I think myself, and this is purely my own theory, but I think that because of the time it was in Ireland with the new state, and she was from an Anglo-Irish background, I think she kind of didn't fit in anywhere. People didn't really know where to put her. And for that reason, she kind of slipped through the cracks a little bit.
Yeah, we spoke, myself and Owen O'Shea spoke before Christmas there. We were on about, you know, his book about the founding of different political parties in Ireland. And we were talking about, you know, I suppose before the Rising, around the Rising you had, and World War One, you had women playing a real active role, and coming them on was huge. And then when the state gets founded, it's like women are pushed out, pushed to the sides. Mm-hmm. Like you mentioned, Sophie Pierce, she was playing a pivotal role during the war, being a mechanic and all that, and driving and everything. But then it was kind of seen the women's role was completely pushed out, and maybe her name gets lost because of that as well.
Yeah, and I mean, when like she had to battle to get her commercial pilot's license, women weren't allowed. They were just basically ruled out. So the International Commission for Aviation just changed the rules to say candidates must be of the male sex. Well, that just wiped out all the women candidates in one swipe of the pen, and she battled that, and she won that battle. She got to have her commercial license, but then the culture wouldn't allow it. So no airline company would hire a female pilot because they felt that no passenger would fly if the pilot was a woman. And even now, I was just looking up statistics the other day. Ireland is second in the world in the numbers of female pilots that we have flying commercially. So India first, then Ireland. But it's still only 9.9% of pilots are women. So, you know, there's still a huge way to go there with that. And she was very instrumental in starting that whole thing off.
Yeah, I can see why you kind of concentrated on one side and then used flashbacks. It's a very clever way, because I remember when we did the documentary, it was six parts because there was so much to her life. And we were saying like, oh, her life could be a movie. But geez, the movie would, it'd be a 3 hours long. Yeah, it'd be massive because like even in Africa, that she was a farmer in Africa, and, you know, there was all these different sites, and she's a Kerry connection. Yeah. And she used to fly around her and do these aeronautical shows and all this kind of a thing. Yes. So it's very clever to concentrate and kind of for her major achievement and kind of come in and out of that.
And I think I have to credit Joseph O'Connor. He was one of my lecturers in the MA in creative writing in UL when I was there. And I spent a long time trying to figure out how to structure this book and asking lots of different people. And it was actually when I read his first book on Hugh O'Flaherty, My Father's House, that I kind of went, oh, okay, you can bring the focus in really, really narrow to, I think that book takes place over pretty much a weekend. It's only a couple of days, but you learn enough about the characters in those couple of days to understand who they are and what they're about. So that kind of got me thinking then that maybe instead of trying to encompass everything she did, because I think it would actually make a better TV series, but it would probably run for as long as Downton Abbey, because there's no end to what that woman did. But yeah, I decided to just, if I just focus on that flight, I might be able to kind of, you know, crack open enough about her for people to understand who she was.
Yeah, and like if you did do her life story, it'd be a very sad ending as well, because Icarus flew too close to the sun. Lady Icarus, like you mentioned, she dies kind of in a very kind of a sad way eventually, but she has an accident that changes her personality, doesn't she? And then she, I think so she steps out in front of a tram then eventually, is it? Is that what that leads to her death?
Yeah, so her, I suppose her moment in the sun was quite short. She finished that flight in May 1928 and was globally famous and celebrated. And then she was doing kind of a tour of America, and she had a crash there. So her plane crashed into the roof of a factory. She had a very serious brain injury. It didn't look like she was going to survive for a while. And it did change her personality, and it changed her physically as well. She had to retake her pilot's license and go through all those hurdles again. But she, according to herself, she became an alcoholic. And she felt that before the accident, she could have a few drinks socially. But after the accident, if she had a drink, she just couldn't stop. So she married a third time. And I think that marriage was for love. It was a man from the Caribbean. And they came back to Ireland. They set up an air company, and it didn't succeed. It failed. And then they kind of drifted apart. And she ended up in London, pretty much penniless, on her own, in trouble with the police, being picked up for, you know, vagrancy and drunken disorderly and that kind of thing. And then she actually fell down the stairs inside a tram. And the inquest showed that she didn't have any alcohol in her system at the time. It was actually suspected that it was a blood clot relating to the plane accident that she had, which killed her. But she was 42 years of age. And that is the fact that, you know, like, I'm 46 and I haven't, you know, I don't expect to do a fraction of what she did, but the life she lived in those 42 years is just incredible.
Yeah, wow. I forgot she was that young. That's amazing. Yeah. June O'Sullivan there. We'll hear more from June after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's The Mad Monk in Killarney. Serving the finest seafood in a cosy, modern atmosphere. Book your special experience today at seafoodbar.ie.
Now let's return to the final part of the interview I did with June O'Sullivan, Flinch Island-based author, on her book The Sky Is Not Enough on Aviatrix Mary Heath. And June, of course, The Sky Is Not Enough is not your first book. Just a year ago, you also launched The Lighthouse Keeper's Wife. And tell us about that book.
So that book was based on one of the families that lived on in the lighthouse on Skellig Michael, and talking about things, I suppose, that people don't know. A lot of people were surprised to hear that there was a lighthouse on Skellig Michael. So when I was visited there in 2014, I saw there's a grave in the church there of two boys, very young boys, who died. They were the sons of a lighthouse keeper, and they were buried there. Their grave is still there for anyone who goes out. And it just caught my attention immediately, because I had kids a very similar age at the time. And I just wanted to know what happened to them. And the book is very much, the book is from the point of view of their mother, who initially is quite happy to go out to Skellig Michael because it was a good job. It was the mid 1800s. The family would be well looked after, but it's such a treacherous place to live. So again, it was kind of, it's fiction based on a real story, but nothing really is known about the family, or the causes of the boys' deaths is not known. So I invented a lot of what happened there based on what could happen in the mid-1800s. So, you know, it didn't, unfortunately, child mortality was quite high. And when you were somewhere like Skellig Michael with no boat, no way of getting off the island, no medical help, no means of communication, then something very small really could be fatal.
Yeah. Again, we did a documentary on the lighthouses of Kerry, and it just fascinated me to think, like, the families that went out there. And you actually needed a very kind of a resilient brain to kind of operate out in these places, like, absolutely stunning, beautiful and all that, but maybe not to live on these places. And when you mentioned, like, there was mud huts on the mainland, so it was a great job. They would go out to these nice buildings. But kids, having a little baby myself, I couldn't imagine on Skellig's Rock having kids running around out there.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I wouldn't bring kids out there at all until they're at least in their teens, because, you know, it's treacherous. But I've been up to see the house where they lived, up on the lighthouse side. And the yard that they would have had to play in is about 3 foot by 3 foot. And that was the only safe spot, really, on the island for them. And once they went past that, anything was possible.
In relation to that, then, like, you know, the research, is there a lot of research out there in something like that when it is so long ago?
There is. I mean, there was very little known about the family. So I thought I'd find all the notes. You know, lighthouse keepers were brilliant note keepers. But the only thing available on that family was the letter that the dad wrote to the board asking for them to be transferred off the island. That was it. Now, I was able to trace the family around because they went from lighthouse to lighthouse after they left. And I found the dad's will when he passed away. So I was able to find enough about the family. And then I suppose, you know, there's plenty of research done on lighthouses and lighthouse life and, you know, the history of Ireland at that time. So you kind of have to pull from a lot of different sources. But anyone who writes historical fiction will tell you, you kind of absorb all that, you take all that in, and then you have to kind of forget it because you're not writing a history book, you're writing fiction, you're writing a novel. So you need enough of that in your system to be able to make it authentic. But then you need to kind of put it to one side and focus on the characters and the human side of the story.
Mm, yeah, it's all right for context, but you can't just follow along like that. I was talking to Mike Kelly, who's done a one-man play, and we were talking about it's the story, the character. Like his play was set in around the cable station time, you know, but the cable station is almost operating in the background of the actual human family story that's going on. And that's so important. It's like the Titanic. It's Jack and Rose that we're kind of focused on for the whole film, even though it's about such a historical thing.
Well, that's it. Like, people are interested in people, and you know, Skellig is a very interesting location, and the history of aviation in the 19th interesting, but it's not really until you hook on a person who lived their own personal experience that you really, for me anyway, that's what really pulls me in.
But there's a bit of commonality between your two characters here. I'd imagine both strong, resilient women. Is that a coincidence?
I suppose they're the kind of characters that interest me, especially, you know, it's easy to be a strong, resilient woman if you have kind of nice circumstances or not many challenges to meet. These two women had huge challenges to meet and survived them and, you know, went on to, well, in Sophie Pierce's case, went on to achieve great things. I was talking to somebody about the difference between the two characters, and she said, you know, you'd have great sympathy for Eliza, but you'd love to go for a drink with Sophie Beers. So, you know, they're very similar in some ways, but very different than in others.
Yeah. Both lend themselves to good movies. Has that ever entered your head if someone approached you? Yeah. Netflix now came after you?
That's the dream. I wouldn't be saying no. No, that'd be wonderful, yeah. But anyway, we'll keep the fingers crossed.
Yeah. You know, getting a publisher as well, like, it's not that easy. You know, in this country, it's a huge achievement as well. So that must be very kind of a proud thing for you.
Yeah, I suppose I am delighted to have the book published. And I know I'm very lucky because I know there are plenty of writers and plenty of books out there who equally deserve to be published. And it comes down a lot to luck and timing. So I suppose I did the master's in creative writing, but I had been writing for a couple of years before that. And I had actually finished the Lighthouse Keeper's Wife. And I decided that I wanted an agent, because if you want a kind of a long life in publishing, it's good to have an agent to kind of deal with the business side and the negotiations and things like that I'm not good at. So that was kind of my first goal, if you like. And I set about it very methodically. I had a spreadsheet with about 100 names on it, and I just worked my way through, not all of them, but, you know, kept an eye out for people who were interested in the kind of story I was writing. And I also entered competitions. So anytime I had a bit of success there, I was able to kind of contact people on the strength of that. And I was very lucky then to get an agent. She's based in London, and she got the contract with Poolbeg for me. So it was kind of a very long road, but I compare it a lot to building a house. You know, you think you're coming over, looking at the foundations, going, oh my God, this is taking forever. And then suddenly you're in it and you live there. So it was a very long road, but a very kind of a fast finish, thankfully.
Yeah. You're working as a teacher. You've three kids with your husband, Declan. But like, where do you find the time then to be writing? And especially when I asked you, when was the other one published, Lighthouse Keeper's Wife? You said January last year. I was like, geez, that's a good turnover, isn't it?
Well, I suppose with your first book, you have the luxury that it's finished, because nobody's going to take you on until you give them a finished book. So it was pretty much ready to go. It needed a little bit of editing, but not too much. So the turnaround on that one was fast. And then the second book, or the Sky Is Not Enough, I had started, because the advice that everybody will give you is, as soon as you start sending your first book out to try and get an agent or publisher, you start working on your second book. And there's kind of two reasons for that. Number one, you stop yourself from going mad, because, you know, you can get quite hyper focused on checking your emails and seeing has anyone come back to you yet. So it does kind of, you know, keep your focus away from that. But also, a lot of the time, agents and publishers want to see what else you have in the pipeline. So if you've only got one book and you've no other ideas and you don't know what you're doing next, it's not so attractive for them. So I took that advice on board, and I got cracking with the second book pretty quickly. And I have a contract with Poolbeg, so it's for four books, and it is meant to be one a year, but I'm not sure the next one will be delivered on time.
Yeah. And can you speak about the next one, or is that all hush hush?
Well, it will be historical fiction as well. It's still very much only an idea. I haven't written a single word yet. Similar, I suppose, historical fiction set in Ireland, might even be set in Kerry. And I'm moving away a little bit this time from having a real woman from history as the main character. Partly, I suppose, it gives me a bit more freedom to invent, but also, I have a character I'm interested in, but there is a real woman starting to creep into the background. So I think she will be there as a minor character. And it's lovely, if I can in any way at all, to kind of shine light on some of these women who might have been forgotten about or kind of overlooked a little bit.
It's a magical sphere, though, I think, you know, when you've something in your head and you're able to bring this person to life. It is magic, I think, in a way, you know. It must be amazing, you know, when it's just like floating around in your head, and then a year later it's living and it's breathing.
Yeah, it's amazing, and it's also terrifying. I think when The Lighthouse Keeper's Wife was coming out last year, I mean, it was incredibly exciting. It was a dream come true. It was everything I'd ever wanted, to have a book in a bookshop and to be able to go in and see it on the shelf there. But there was also the terror of, okay, now people are going to read it. Which sounds a bit daft, but, you know, once it's out there in the wild, people are going to read it and have their own opinions on it, and, you know, have their own kind of thoughts on whether it's good or not. You just have to take that as it comes. And I've been very lucky with the first book, that like the reception to it has been really positive overall. So anyone who had anything negative to say about it didn't tell me.
More
of that, please.
I'm looking at the front covers here. They're kind of the same style. They look, very kind of visually impressive as well. Who did them for you? They're lovely artwork.
Poolbeg. So I suppose another thing I learned is that the writer has no input, or very little input really, into the cover.
Okay.
And I was okay with that, because I said, look, that's not my area of expertise. These people know what they're doing. So I absolutely loved both covers, and especially the second one. I think they've really captured her, even with the fur coat and the, you know, her stature, even though she's quite small on the front cover. I think they've kind of captured how powerful a figure she was, even in that.
Yeah. So where can people go to get The Sky Is Not Enough? It'll be for sale from early next week.
Yes. So in all good bookshops, as they say, our own fantastic Coleman Quirks shop here in Carrisavine. I also need to mention the Skellig Experience. They've been incredibly supportive all throughout their season when they've been open. So the book is available there. It'll be in Eason's, Mahoney's, and as well the library. I grew up on libraries and have, you know, always brought my own kids to the library, and can't say enough good things about that. So it should be in all bookshops and libraries from next week.
Excellent.
And there'll also be an audiobook out in, I think, February, a couple of weeks after the physical book. So that's something people are really into these days.
Yeah. And for people listening abroad or away, can they get it online?
They can get it on Amazon, and the audiobook will be available on Audible and Spotify.
And you're having two launches then, and I suppose you'd have to have one in Kerry and Limerick to keep everyone happy.
Exactly. Yeah, well, any excuse for a party. So I felt I couldn't launch the book anywhere except Newcastle West. You know, that's where Sophie Pierce belongs. And I'm delighted that it's going to be in the Red Door Gallery. So I don't know if you know that. It's literally two doors up from the AIB bank where she was raised. So we'll be on the same street, which is wonderful. And that is the 7th of February. It's a Saturday evening at 7 o'clock. And then in Port McGee, I'm going to be in the Port McGee Whiskey, the the domes there, just outside the village. And that will be Saturday, the 8th of March. And again, I love the timing of that because it's the weekend of International Women's Day. So it's quite fitting.
Excellent. What time will that be?
Around 7 o'clock as well.
Excellent. The last thing I wanted to ask you, and it's like, you know, I've interviewed a lot of writers that are based here in Kerry. How much does that play a role, do you think, the environment of where you're writing? How much does it help?
Yeah, I think it really does. I suppose with the first book, The Lighthouse Keeper's Wife, we were living on Valentia Island, and it's a very, very different thing to Skellig Michael, but you still do have a little sense of you know, island life, I suppose. And it was during COVID, so I think I really did have a sense of the isolation and being cut off from people that fitted well with the story. And the landscape is just incredible. I think we underestimate it and we kind of forget to notice it at times. And I suppose on a practical level, having three kids and living in South Kerry, I spent a lot of time in the car. So, you know, plenty of time to think and daydream and come up with new ideas and listen to great podcasts for research and things like that. So, yeah, we're very lucky here.
Excellent. I want to wish you all the best of luck with it. June, I can't wait to read it, and continued success. It's great to hear of another up-and-coming writer, and a writer that's doing so well as well in the county. So congratulations, and enjoy the two launches.
Thank you, Joe.
Yeah, that was June O'Sullivan, who I caught up with earlier in the week, and I want to wish June again all the best. Now we're going to take a break, and we'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across the county. Serving the freshest seafood to Kerry families since 1963.
Now, I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. A lot of you are getting in touch with me in relation to In Focus with Dominic Walsh, and wanting a reminder of what the theme was for In Focus. So the theme was Don't Look Back, and in brackets, Looking Forward. So it's kind of an abstract kind of a theme. So it's up to you what you want to make of that. It was kind of into the new year, no looking back, looking forward. And it can be kind of a positive kind of a photo, or whatever you want to put a slant on, whatever slant you want to put on it. It's no problem at all. You can email them to jmcgill@radiokerry.ie before midday Wednesday, before the first Saturday of the month. And remember, just up to three photos. You can do one, two or three photos. And we like a little story with them as well. So jmcgill@radiokerry.ie. I want to congratulate Ballymac and Unreltacht on their great wins. And also we have to wish all the best to Dingle as well, though, to make it a clean sweep for the county. I was listening to Darrell Caneda during the week. He spoke so eloquently and so brilliantly about how important the win was to Unreltacht, but then just about living in the area and the importance of keeping the community vibrant. I thought he spoke so well done to him and everyone else involved there. And also, of course, the Dingle game will be broadcast live on Radio Kerry, so make sure to be tuned for that. Now we're going to take a break for the news at 10, and in the next hour we'll be talking to Clare native Joe Queeley about his book Tragedies of Clare, which has a Kerry connection.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by the new family fish box at Quinlan's Seafood Bars, packed with golden fish goujons, fresh squid, delicious prawns and tasty homemade chips. Order yours to take away today. The Saturday Supplement with Joe McGill on Radio Kerry.
Now we're into the second hour of the Saturday Supplement, and I hope you're enjoying the programme so far. Later on, we'll have another episode of An Artist's Kingdom, and we'll be going to South Kerry to Carisveen-based artist Helen Richmond. But first, Joe Queeley has a new book called The Tragedies of Clare, which includes episodes relating to the land war and the years around the Easter Rising, one of the stories having a strong Kerry connection. And Joe Queeley joins me on the line now. Joe, you're very welcome. How are you this morning?
Good morning, Joe, and good morning, Kerry.
So, Joe, I suppose the first question is to ask how and why you decided to write such a book.
Now, I suppose, I heard you mentioning there about South Kerry, so we'll be going to South Kerry again in a couple of minutes, Joe. I think that my inspiration in writing the book actually came from Kerry, The Tragedies of Clare. It was by Dorothy McArdle. Dorothy wrote an absolute superb book, 1922, 1923, on Tragedies of Kerry. And I read it, and you have to read it over and over again, and it compels you to read it, to be honest about it. It invites you, drags you in with the stories and the sadness. And I just wondered, had anybody done the story of Tragedies of Clare? And, like, you know, I said, Joe, wouldn't it be great to do it? So I have already had a few old books done, the Fanagh School case and Echoes from the Civil War, and I deem myself a bit of a scribbler more than an author or a historian. But I said, I'm going to do Tragedies of Clare. And there was a tragedy up very, very close to us in the Burden, where I come from. I come from the heart of the Burden, above John Ball, the John Love. And there was a Kerry connection to it, but the big Kerry connection, the big connection to it first was, I didn't know the Kerry connection, to be honest about it, but the big connection was that there was an informer and he brought 7 Clare men to the gallows to be hung. And I said, God above, who was he? Where was he from? What does he look like? Or whatever. So I got dug into the Tragedies of Clare, and I put 3 stories, but the big one I found in was up in Knocklare, Joe, where in the 11th of September 1887, where moonlighters attacked a house, and what they thought they knew was there was somebody inside in the house that had grabbed land, and they were to take him out and shoot him. They would take him out and shoot him, and because he had grabbed land, or they had seen that he had grabbed land, but what they didn't know that there was an informer in their midst. And when they hit the house, which is situated between Liston Varna and Kilfenora, the great Kilfenora Kelly band, everyone has heard of those, yeah, that there was 14 policemen in place to capture them.
Whoa.
And Joe, we're talking about Clare here, and, you know, we are speaking about the Kerry connection as well. Both counties, very similar. You know, rugged landscapes with vast coastlines, and the environment has an important role to play in the stories and the tragedies here as well.
It is a vast coastline, and I suppose the beauty of the sea, you know, the coastlines and where we come from. I come from between the mountain and the sea in Fanagh, and those places. The kind of hone you, they build you to their own liking, unbeknown to yourself. They used to say one time that anybody that came from the sea was kind of wild, and anybody that came from the mountain was as wild, and those that came between the mountain and the sea was even wilder again. Mm. And that's the kind of people that you had that time as well, Joe. You know, like when you hit Tragedies of Kerry, Kerry had great freedom fighters. Great freedom fighters down South Kerry, down Scatterglen and out Cashel Island and all them places. They had great freedom fighters, you know, and they were the only people that time that the peasant farmer had to fight for them in getting back their bit of land. And that time, Joe, and I think, you know, you had the moonlighters the Bordyke evictions in 1887 was possibly the biggest in Ireland that time. And you had the moonlighters, you had the white boys, you had the Carders, you had the Rogers, but they were all moonlighters. And the biggest, Joe, the biggest that time, and everybody in Kerry that's listening to us, you know, this morning will tell you that they know what I'm talking about. The worst of the whole lot of the moonlighters, the whole of that group were the Féach Dubhs. And the Féach Dubh was the black crow of the raven. And the Féach Dubh that time, you know, was a person. The Féach Dubh was a person, Joe, that, you know, that they saw the vulnerability of someone created that was on the last legs and that wasn't able to do their own business. And they moved in to take their place, to take their house, to take their money, to take their land. They moved in. And people, Kerry people, mountain Kerry people and not mountain Kerry people, I live on the Great Baskets an awful lot. And you know, the people out there will tell you that when they're missing a sheep or a lamb, after a day, you don't look at the ground, you look at the mountain, you look at the sky to see where the Féach Dubh is, ready to come down and take the eyes out of the crater of a lamb or maybe a little sheep that's in the flat of her back lambing or whatever. And the Féach Dubh that time was wasn't the person that moved in to take the land of the people. And that's what the Moonlighters had to continue. And the night that they went to the Ballygastel outrage near Kilfenora, and that night there were seven brave men in that group of people. And I suppose the most unfortunate, the biggest thing of the tragedies of Clare and the Kerry connection was that the informer was with them that night, and he brought them into the back door of the house, because the back door was a trap. There was some outhouses which were tied onto the gable end in the back of the house, so they went in, they couldn't come out. And there was a constable killed that night, Constable Gerard Whelehan. He was from Mullingar in County Westmeath. And the seven lads were brought up for murder, because they were all part of the murder, even that five of them were under arrest while the murder took place. But there were, I'd say, maybe 3 or 4 days in court when they realised that this man from Stratagain, South Kerry, had informed. He was the informer, and he was now in police protection. And I suppose the intrigue of the whole story was, where the seven of them hung? Where the seven of them hung? And I remember, I have it in the book. Now, you say you have to buy the book to find out, Joe, number one, who the man from Stratagain was. You have to buy the book. And she's in Pat O'Connell's Kinmare bookshop, and I think she's in the Key bookshop, and all the big bookshops around, Charlie Burden's and Innes bookshop, and you can get it online, so you have to. But there was a lot of twists and turns, and you know, the grabbers that time, Parnell Dillon and Michael Davitt said that you must shun them in the street when you meet them, you must shun them at the fairs, you must shun them inside in the church, they must be put down. And the terrible tragedy of the Clare one was that where the Moonlighters came up, he wasn't really a grabber, he was sexton from West Clare, and they were very, very decent people, and he wanted to let the man back in that had been thrown out of the house. He wanted to let him back in, but the Land League wanted a kind of a show. They wanted a victim to say, this is what happens if you do something. And you know, it's only fair to give Joe, when you're telling history, you have to tell it as it is, and you have to tell the truth, the whole truth, and then nobody can come back at you. But the Saxons were very good people, the people that were supposed to have grabbed this land. They didn't really grab it. But a man had been put out of it, and he said, look, go back into it. I have it for you. You go back into it. But anyway, the Land League that time were kind of a peaceful group, but the underbelly of a dissident group of the Moonlighters took the law into their own hands, and they administered the law as they saw fit, and they were going up that night to shoot Sexton, and they probably, maybe we won't judge, they would have probably have shot Sexton that night and killed him. But the row rose, and one of the head constables got killed that night, and the seven men were brought up, and the hangman that time, I think it was Marwood, he said that he could hang the seven of them together. Yeah. And I suppose the intrigue was where the eight of seven hung. And again, I was going to say you have to buy the book for that, but there weren't really. Because Peter the Packer that time, he was Peter O'Brien, he was hitting for Chief Justice. And there was a bit of negotiations in the background, because he was from Kilfenora too. Though, even though it was an O'Brien man from Cork that was the judge. But some of the people that were, the Moonlighters had fought for Peter O'Brien when he was going for MP. They had fought for him, and they got injured for him. One of them got a cut in the neck of a tail of scissors. So in the book, when I was writing it, I you know, the five of the lads got I think 10 years and 5 years and 7 years in jail, but they weren't hung. And I remember saying, you know, the tail of scissors was probably what them got out of it, because they had fought for Peter the Packer, who was Chief Justice, or going on to be Chief Justice at the time. And I remember asking in the three things in the book was a bad defence counsel, a good defence counsel, a bad prosecution counsel, or the tail of scissors that saved seven men from the gallows.
Whoa.
And the man from Stratagain, Joe, the man from Stratagain, he was vulnerable too. In fairness, we have to tell the story. He was vulnerable. He was an alcoholic, and the police that time, saw the weakness, and they started giving him money to inform these people, and he had also taken money in Kerry for the South Kerry people, the Scottish in Cashel Island, got to couple those people down that area. He had taken money for that as well, but it was money for drink. Mm. It was money for drink, and the police set up the Moonlighters, this man to infiltrate the Moonlighters and to set up the raid in the house.
Yeah, it's amazing, and to find out more about that tragedy, like you say, you can read the book. It sounds like there's a movie in it. Anyway, listening to it, did you say you spent time in the Blaskets, Joe?
I live on the Great Blaskets an awful lot. I haven't got out there now in 1 or 2 years, but Joe, my, you know, there are times in your life, Joe, when you hit a wall.
Yeah.
When you hit a wall in your lifetime, you know what I mean? So where do you go when you hit the wall? Whether that be, you know, when you're sitting down in the chair, or when you're lying over in bed, and there's stuff going through your head. I go to the Blaskets. I go to the Blaskets in my head. And that beautiful, you know, down to the Thorbar, back to the Gob, up to the Crow, back to Clown Dove, and up there with one of my great friends, Sue Redigan. Sue was the Theodore in the Blaskets. And we drank more tea together and ate more hairy bacon outside in the Blaskets. And we danced with Christopher McGarrett and the Slatteries. And all them people, you know, and to sleep below, just as a small little hut there at Brontishandon Levy, and a small house, lovely little house with a kitchen and a room upstairs in it, and the bed in the corner of the bed in the corner of the house, an old island home of the Dunleavys. And my God, when you go into that and you put on and you have to go to the bucket of water, and when you go into that house, you know, and the wind, you hear the wind whispering, the wind whispers, the sound of the seals and the sound of the men's shearwalkers and the puffing, and it brings you down to the chimney. That's as close to heaven as you'll ever get, Joe.
And were you there physically, or is this in your mind, you're telling me?
Oh, no, I was there physically. Oh, God, I went out there for the last 40 years, I say. Oh. But I'm just saying, Joe, you take your mind out to the Blaskets.
Yeah,
you just bring yourself out to the Blaskets, and this is the positivity that you put into your head.
Yeah.
To challenge John Donoghue. John was a great priest one time here in Fanorn. He wrote lovely books, Annam Cara and all these. And John, you say you have to challenge down stuff that Tom Minces.
Yes.
It was lovely. John was gifted with words, because John Donoghue, people should look up his books, Father John Donoghue, and he wrote Annam Cara and Blessings and all those. But John, you say, you know, you have to have something to challenge down stuff that Tom Minces.
Yes.
So when you go to the Blaskets, you know, when you're inside in bed or wherever you are, Joe, you know,
yeah,
when the wall comes against you,
yes,
you automatically bring that in to challenge what's tormenting you inside in your head, whether it is, you know, sometimes, you know, with families and one thing or another,
yeah,
and all those stuff that torments us, all those silly stuff that comes in,
yeah,
and that. So I'd go to the Blaskets and I'd go down to the Thorburn it's just such a beautiful place to be, to just let the, you know, the sound of the seals.
Yes.
There's maybe 700,000 seals there up the mothers. The mother seals up to have their baby seals out in Seals Cove, just around the corner from Travard. And that's when you hear whisper in the wind, you know, that coming down the chimney.
Yeah.
Is there anything, any place or anything in the wide earthly world more beautiful than that?
Yeah, it's a great way. We have to go to a break, so I want you to stay with me. And Nelson Mandela was a big advocate of that when he was in his cell in South Africa as well. I suppose it's mindfulness, that's what it is. Joe, stay with us. We'll have more after these.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Enjoy a simple, healthy and easy dinner solution with Quinlan's fresh, ready-made seafood meals. Available in store.
Joe Queeley is on the line talking about his new book, The Tragedies of Clare, which includes episodes relating to the land war and the years around the Easter Rising, one of the stories, like we said, having a strong Kerry connection. And Joe, before the break, we were talking about the Blaskets and that you spend time on them. And I did a short feature series where we went live to the past. So I would go back to a particular time in history. I went back to the evacuation of the Blasket Islands. And I also, just in the autumn there, we had a staycation, myself and my family, around the Dingle Peninsula. And I went into the Blasket Centre and I kind of went on a Blaskets binge after that. But what did strike me, and you'd be well placed, like, it was a tough, tough place to live. Like you described the beautiful, magical side of it, but it was a hard environment as well, I'd imagine. And like your best place is saying that you spent time there.
It was awful tough. It was awful tough. There's no doubt about that. The sea of the Blasket found treacherous. As a matter of fact, I'd say that it never came. Even on a fine day, you'll get a fine toss going out with the lads out, the Shatteries now, and those lads. I'm not sure if they're doing the boats anymore now. Doggy O'Shea did the boats with us for many, 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 many years. But like, it was a threat. There isn't, I would go as far as saying that there isn't one a flat piece of ground on the Blaskets. You're climbing all the time. All the time. And you know, I suppose it was that hardship, you know, and that challenge that made the writers, Marisha Sullivan, you know, Peg Sayers, Michal Green, all them people. So that's what draws me to it. I remember being on the Blaskets maybe for 5 or 6 days on my own or more. One time the boats went away. You know, but you have the option of going off if you wanted to go off. And, you know, and I was there on my own for maybe 5 or 6 days. And I remember the boats came back and it was going away from the Blaskets. And I felt sad because you go away, the boat pulls you away from the Blaskets. Do you know what I mean? It doesn't go sideways. It just goes away from the Blaskets. And this woman, American lady, came up. She was a tourist in for the day. And she said, "Sir," she says, "could you tell me what time it is?" And I said, "Madame, I couldn't tell you what day it is, because I and she said, "Honey," she said to the husband of the guy here, "he doesn't know what day it is of the week." So it takes you. It, you know.
Yeah.
That hardship, Joe. That hardship. That history. That sound. You know, it was awful. It was evacuated in 1953. The Great Blaskets. And you know, it's such a lovely place. The only way that you could bring life to the Blaskets is to have a helicopter service twice, three times a day. No, that's the only way, because it's not fair on the Blasket, on the island people, not to be able to bring their children to school from the Blaskets. To the mainland, do you know what I mean? And you know, there could be there, I said, for the winter months, you could be isolated in the Blaskets maybe for 2 months solid.
Yeah, yeah,
I think Uncrow could be maybe the highest point of the island. I think it could be maybe 1,000, maybe 1,200 feet up.
Yeah.
You know, and if you wouldn't walk the island on a windy day, you'd be blown off of it.
Yeah.
You'd have to go on your knees along. I often had to go on my two knees along the Crow, because you wouldn't just stand you up or blow you.
Yeah.
So, Joe, it is a treacherous island.
Yeah. We've only about a minute or two left. Like, not to mention the medical side of it and everything else, and the hunger side when they were trapped, like you say. Moving back to your book, The Tragedies of Clare. You cover two other tragedies as well in the book, just briefly.
We did. One of them was, and believe it or not, the only other place that has happened too, that there was an attempted murder. A man's throat was caught inside in the church in a place called Dallin Ruin, which is in the village in the parish of Crisheen, which is just outside Innes. And that was over kind of land and love and money as well. And then the execution of Francie Hines, again over moonlighting and land, and Francie was hung in the wrong. He was executed in the wrong. They wanted a victim, and he was a very, very young man, and he was executed in the wrong in Limerick Jail. That was about the 1880s as well. You know, the one in Crisheen was 1916, I think, or maybe 19, yeah. Up 1919, maybe. And so those, but to be honest about it, Joe, like Kerry, you know, you could pick that's three. You could pick 33 tragedies. Yeah. You could pick 43 tragedies in Kerry or 43 in Clare or in Cork or any place. Because, and I suppose, it's well to remember, Joe, as well, you know, that tis the people that fought for the land were poor people. The people that fighting in Ukraine at the minute are poor people. The people that are fighting in the Russian army are poor. It was all poor people that fought our battles. And when the camp settled, it was the rich people that moved in to pick up the pieces and take the land. Now, Joe, before we go from you, my book can be got on just Google Tragedies of Clare and I'll send out a book to you. And also, it's in Perriconnell's Kenmare Bookshop, Key Bookshop, Charlie Burton's Ears Bookshop. You're getting there. And it's a great book, and it's a great read because it tells about us.
Excellent. Joe, it was an absolute pleasure. Best of luck with it. And I look forward to having a chat with you again in the near future.
And we might meet on the Great Glasgow and Vasquez Pool sometime.
Yes, definitely. That is Joe.
Thanks, Joe.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars located across Kerry. Take the fear out of fish and chat to our fishmongers about how to add delicious, easy-to-cook seafood into your menu. Oven and air fryer-ready meals available.
Now it's time to hear another episode of An Artist's Kingdom, and it's time to go to just outside Carraseveen to visit Helen Richmond.
This documentary is a Kishta Communications production, funded by Cumashuna Man with a television licence fee.
This is Artist's Kingdom, an 8-part radio series that takes listeners on an immersive journey into the diverse and vibrant world of artists in County Kerry. Through the lens of creativity, we will explore the unique cultural landscape that has inspired generations of artists, shaping their work and contributing to the rich artistic tapestry of the region. The series will gather some of the finest artists in the county, where they share a dedication to their art. We will explore some of the most impressive and interesting Kerry-based artists today, who are truly doing their county proud. Helen Richmond was born in Dublin. Upon graduating from the National College of Art and Design in 1990, she moved to Carraseveen, from where she has since conducted her art practice. She resumed her studies at NCAD in 2015 and completed a master's degree in 2017. She used this study opportunity to deepen and broaden her approach to research methods, resulting in the development of exciting new directions for her work. Her professional career spans from 1990, and she has had numerous solo exhibitions nationally, and she has worked in many public and private collections. She is also an educator, teaching painting at Tech Armagan and Arts and Adult Education Centre in Waterville.
My name is Helen Richmond, and I am a visual artist. I'm a painter, and my deep interest is my connection with nature.
Although now living in Kerry, Helen grew up in Dublin.
Well, I was born very close to the sea in Blackrock in County Dublin, and I would have spent a lot of my childhood outside, either down in Blackrock Baths swimming, which I was doing again this morning, or outside in the garden playing with kids down the road. There was also a lot of kind of derelict places at that stage still. The Frascati Centre hadn't been built. Blackrock Shopping Centre was an orchard, so we went picking blackberries in the Frascati Centre. There was Kerrysfore Convent, they still had a farm there, so there was quite a lot of places that were still accessible back then, and I think that probably what started me off on my, probably is also because I was the third child and it was summer when I was born, so I was probably just put out in the pram and left under the apple trees.
As a child, there were plenty of opportunities for painting.
My mother was always good at flower arranging and colour, but she never painted anything. I don't think she would have had the patience, and she definitely wouldn't have had the time with all of us. But and my dad was always interested in culture. He was a professor of Greek, We always grew up hearing kind of ancient mythology and stories from different places. We would also have had a great familiarity just with looking at Greek art. I always remember he had a colleague as well who, I don't know how she got them, but she used to get these floral calendars from Japan that had very stylized kind of flower arrangements in them, and these used to be brought home to us once a year. Also, we used to go out for walks every Sunday nearly, because how else would you keep four kids quiet back in the 70s? We were very lucky. We had an endless supply of paper that one side had been used for my father's typewriter and the other side was blank. So we used to get out the markers, go under the table and, paint or draw whatever I'd seen when I was out on a walk with the family. My earliest known work was apparently a sculptural attack on the toilet with a hammer after a plumber had arrived. And I think after that, I went on to engraving the headboard of the bed with my brother's compass. So there was never going to be any stopping me. So you can see why I got the markers.
Helen went on to study art in secondary school.
So in secondary school, I did do art, but as with most places in Ireland back in the 70s and early 80s, art really wasn't taught very much as a subject. So in my situation, what used to happen was that the good people were just left alone to do what they wanted, and the bad people's paintings were painted for them. So I think I really enjoyed the fact that I was just left alone and get on with what I wanted to do, which kind of in general education didn't really seem to be helping you to do that.
Being an artist when Helen was leaving school was not seen as a steady career path, but for Helen, it was always what she was going to do.
I just did it and I just kept doing it and I keep on doing it, and that's as far as it goes with me. The idea of making money out of it was firmly knocked on the head from the very, very beginning. There was no way. Now, mind you, I did actually sell pictures of the Pope for at 50 cent, I think. I was a budding entrepreneur. So it was just something that I was always going to be doing. And then when... And I always got really good marks in art and made something that I liked and other people seemed to like as well when I was doing it. So when it came to leaving school, it was my best subject. So it seemed a bit stupid not to be doing something that was your best subject. So I didn't get straight into art college, which anybody who's listening now might be interested in knowing, because I had no idea what to put into a portfolio. So I got a FOSS job with a stained glass company for a year, and I did stained glass with them and I did night classes, and the next year all the colleges wanted me. So it just goes to prove that I wasn't any different a person. My talents weren't any different. I knew stuff and I knew what was required. I think there's great hope in that for anybody who actually maybe doesn't get exactly what they want the first time.
Helen would have been exhibiting her work from early on, and her first exhibitions were part of her college work.
So I would have had an exhibition for the diploma and for the degree, and then my first exhibition after the college, I was here in South Kerry because I left college and there was no great career plans or anything about what you would do. So I decided I had made some money from my degree show and I said, well, I'll just keep painting until the money runs out and then see, does anybody want to buy them? So a very simple plan. So I got down here and the guards came to my door and because I had no phone, like I had no car, nothing when I came down here. I just had my bike. So I rented a house off Matty Quirk and the rest is history. But the guard came to my door and I was kind of going, God, what's happened? So he said, are you Helen Richmond? I said, I am. There's a call here for you. There's a gallery in Dublin wants to talk to you. So I rang them up and they offered me my first solo show. And I was with that gallery for years and years, yeah, until the gallery actually shut.
So how did Helen end up in Kerry?
At my exhibition, I can technically say that I'm not a blow-in because I was actually invited by a lady, Aileen Burns. She knew my mother. They were at college together. And she's. I had already spent about a month down in West Cork doing my own thing, painting, minding a house for somebody. And she had said, oh, you should come down to South Kerry. So I took out the map and I had a look and I was good at geography. So I was good at reading contours and stuff. And I said, well, that looks like quite promising territory, like for a landscape painter, because I was already into painting the landscape around me. And you might think there isn't any in Dublin, but there was Booterstown Marsh. There was the whole seafront there when the tide goes out. So that was more or less what I was painting at the time. But she invited me down. And so I came, was offered an exhibition within 2 weeks of arriving here, like without even looking for it. So I was incredibly lucky. I got a lucky break and I took it. And I've been here ever since.
The techniques Helen uses in her work have evolved over time.
The techniques of my work have varied a lot, and I guess when I had finished, while I was in art college, I had done both very realistic and very abstract work, and that's a pattern that has kind of I suppose recently continued, but when I came down here I was painting very thickly within pastel paint, making almost like brocade, heavily painted images of mostly the bog here. And it's funny because the bog just down the road there, it was winter time, and I came down at the beginning of November when the grasses are at their most orange and beautiful, and the colours are just really, really vivid, and a big change from the summer colours, kind of sometimes more interesting because you still get greens in winter, but you get all these beautiful warm tones as well to counteract the rain. So I was painting quite thickly then, and over the years that changed. It was always quite spontaneously, and I always loved the quality of paint, but I was mostly painting in oils, then as I went on, in some ways, although there was always many kind of levels of meaning in the paintings, they became outwardly more realistic looking. And then I changed everything. I went completely abstract.
A recent exhibition by Helen and Shum Tatira brought the music of the Iveragh Peninsula to life. Turn to Tira, or Ground Waves, was a collaboration with Peter Mullarkey, who is the founder of the Binnis Collection, an archive of traditional music and songs from the Iveragh Peninsula. Helen's work was inspired by a tune composed by a Ballydarrig Moorman named Jar Coffey, who passed away some years ago. Basing herself around his old cottage at his home place, she began to make paintings of the natural world around her. Using his tune as an inspiration, She wondered if she couldn't turn the sound waves into colours, and eventually she came up with a notation system, using the frequencies of hertz in the music and using corresponding terahertz, which is a unit to measure colour. The result was three giant scrolls, which abstract both the music and the sense of place.
So, in the exhibition Tontatira, I devised a musical notation system where every note was based on a colour that I saw when I was out on site in the composer's home area. And they were all put together in time signatures as well. Like, so if a note was three beats, it would be this big. If a note was worth one beat, it would be this big. And I painted an 80-foot watercolour, which may, I'm not sure, be the biggest watercolour in the world, all around the round gallery of Siúm Sa Tíre. It was quite special when that went up on the wall, because I only got to see it about 2 days before that when we were putting it together, as I had made it in 9 pieces of paper. It was great to finally see it up on the wall. We've hung it up with Velcro, and I was very relieved and delighted that my extra thick Velcro managed to stick and stay up there. What we have in front of us is called a Caladni plate. It's a flat metal plate. It vibrates, wobbles the metal plate on the top. It's attached to signalling system that Bluetooths to my phone. On the phone, I have an app called a tone generator, and if I press a note on that on the phone, a tone travels up the wires into the tone generator, and that vibrates, wobbles the metal plate on the top, and then you get a pattern, and each pattern is different for each tone. So if you put an A sharp into the tone generator, you will get a particular pattern. I can't remember what the one I did here was. I think it might have been A. So I started to use them in my work. In some work, I made prints of the actual notes from the Caladni plate. And I'll show you that in operation now. Okay, so first I sprinkle salt. This is like dancing on the radio. First of all, I sprinkle the salt on the Caladni plate. So it's kind of fairly evenly covered, so you can be sure that it's not a pattern of your imagination that comes. And then hopefully that salt will be dry enough, because the weather here is quite wet. And then you press the play on your tone generator. It's set to 440 hertz, and hopefully we will see a pattern emerge. And there you can see the pattern that comes from playing 440, which, as you know, is A. So what I do then is I have a flexible plate, which I can actually show you one of them. It's just down here. I found it this morning when I was tidying the studio. So you've got a flexible plate like this. This is a little bit smaller than the one I printed from. And what I did was I painted on that with a roller. So it's all covered in green or whatever. And then you take off your plate, unscrew it there, and plonk this down on top. And you can turn it over if you want. And then you get an imprint here. And I can just show you just some very rough ones that I had. These were the ones that didn't make the exhibition. But they are the patterns of a couple of notes, kind of one over the other. This is one I did with turf dust. I don't know if I have any more with the actual... Yeah, there's some other ones. That's a few different notes, one on top of the other. And I introduced the flowers and bits of grass and wild things from the area that I was painting. These are all done from Jer Coffees up in Ballydarrig in Filemore, because that was the tune that I first chose to explore from the Binna's archive, thanks to Peter Mullarkey, who has been a very patient fiddle teacher for a long time. So this whole project kind of came really out of the community, due to the friends that I have and people that I play music with.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry. Brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry. Supplement your diet with a healthy and fresh dinner option. Fresh seafood from Quinlan's.
Now let's return to the final part of the episode with Helen Richmond of An Artist's Kingdom. Helen likes to create abstract work, and her paintings are highly thought-provoking, like this piece she created a number of years ago.
It was called Liminal Bondholders. So at the time, the recession was kicking in big time. It was about 2009 or 10, I think. And everything was shifting and changing, and people's consciousness again was shifting and changing a lot. So if you look at this painting here, it's a very simple image of steps going down into the sea, and it was actually, that one was actually taken from Rean Pier and in Ballinskellig's or near Ballinskellig's. And again, there's that thing of going into a different mode, transitioning from the land to the sea. But also you see these ropes and different types of ropes in that are tied to the land but connecting to the world of the sea. So as well, I was kind of thinking, you know, some of the boats that would be in there in the summertime could be the yachts of the rather wealthy. So there's different types of ropes there. And so it's up to you to think about who they're connecting and who's connecting to what and how. And I think as well, like, that was something that was coming out in the newspapers a lot at the time there, as to how different people were connected to each other and banks and, you know, all that kind of stuff. So that just kind of filtered into that unintentionally. But yeah, so that would be a very simple image. But like, in some ways, I was always kind of thinking abstractly with even the most realistic images. Like, if I was painting cows, I could have been thinking of how the cow was always like a unit of an economic unit in Ireland, and the cow as a symbol of plenty are associated with little farms and farming and struggle down in this part of the world, maybe.
Helen is also an educator and teaches art.
I teach in Kerry ETB in Tachamorgan in Waterville, and I also teach a kids class from my home. And it's very stimulating being a teacher in the community, because I meet people that I definitely would not otherwise meet. I get to experience what's blocking learners as well. And I guess it's always the same probably wherever you go. It's fear, and fear of judgment, generally. I've been a teacher for what, over 25 years maybe now. But it's difficult to balance the art and the teaching, and at the moment it's just kind of half and half. So it's always a balancing act. But I definitely think that I would not teach the way I teach unless I was an artist. So my teaching relies on my art practice, definitely.
And if people want to find out more about Helen Richmond, where should they go?
So if anybody wants to see my work, they can either have a look on Instagram or go on my website, and or they can contact me through Kerry ETB as well, in Tech Armagan. I'm very easy to find and very friendly, and there's a sign outside my house with my phone number on it.
The Saturday Supplement on Radio Kerry, brought to you by Quinlan's Fish Shops and Seafood Bars, located across Kerry, because at least one day of the weekend should involve someone else doing all the cooking. Order your delicious takeaway from Quinlan's today.